My name's Debbie King, and I have the pleasure of hosting today's telecraft. It's a great honour for me to work in association with Paul Webber at Webber Training, along with my colleagues Maria Belalic and Lauren Chu, to bring you today's UK teleclass. Julie Storr, many of you will know the name and have had the pleasure of meeting her personally, in addition to being the recently elected Vice President of the Infection Prevention Society in the UK. Julie works at the World Health Organization in patient safety and has a background of working in infection prevention and control in the UK. And we're delighted that she's with us today to make her presentation to us, Moving Closer to Nirvana, the importance of nurse empowerment in preventing HCAI. So, Julie, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Debbie, for that. Today, I am going to address this much explored subject of nurse empowerment and its relationship to the prevention and control of infection. As you can see from the objectives of this session, there is going to be some exploration of the literature, and there is a lot of literature on this subject, broadly speaking. There's a raft of papers dating back decades around nurse empowerment. As you start to connect it with infection prevention and control, the literature tends to lessen, although some of the seminal work, which I will briefly refer to from people like Elaine Larson, from Professor Sito, way back in the 90s, did address this subject. And it's one of those things that comes in and out of fashion, as will become clear during this session. So just looking at that screen, the objectives of the session, looking at the literature, trying to address to some extent the impact of culture, organisational, institutional culture on the ability to achieve empowered nurse status. And clearly, you know, we will be limited in the level of exploration that can be undertaken here in this short session, culture being such a vast academic discipline in its own right in the field of infection prevention and control and patient safety. And then looking at the role of the nurse, and I appreciate that nurses are not the only players in the game of infection prevention and control, IPC, but the nursing workforce is the biggest in healthcare. We have to target in equal measure much of our efforts and energies on this particular discipline. And given that infection prevention and control, nurses tend, by and large, to be the leaders in the field, the influencers, the leaders, the motivators. I'm particularly interested in exploring that connection. But when you hear the word nurse, it's not exclusively nurses that this session does apply to. So we're going to have a whirlwind exploration here of this subject. I know many of you will have looked at this in various guises, whether from your own academic interests as you've been pursuing courses or in terms of constructing your approaches locally to the prevention of infection. So if we move on to the next slide, here we have a paper that I was involved in writing with a colleague, and we undertook a literature review of this subject of nurse leadership and empowerment, particularly in relation to patient safety. We really tried to find papers in the published literature in the English-speaking world which had looked at impact in its relation to leadership, advocacy, interdisciplinary working, empowerment and collaboration, and whether these things actually did from any studies we could find, and some of those were audits and some were full-on research, whether they impacted on outcome. We found in nearly 2,000 papers, and when we actually looked at the rigor and robustness of those papers, we ended up with 11 that we explored in detail. And the quality of those papers was, in itself, those 11 was quite variable. But there was certainly, although there was some evidence of impact of this or effectiveness in terms of nurses directly influencing patient safety, that evidence from that literature was particularly weak. And there was one paper that stood out, really, and I will mention that towards the end of this session. And again, it will come as no surprise to you, but it was the Berenholtz and Pronovost study, where empowerment was one of a number of interventions that seemed to have a big impact on the outcome. Other authors have looked at this in a bigger way, in fact, and some of the sort of, you know, the gurus of quality and safety, and I'm thinking of people like John Ovravit, who have looked at whether leadership is one of the key determinants of outcome in relation to quality. And whilst, again, similar conclusions are reached, what I think is universal from all of the studies is that the counter side of this, i.e. the absence of leadership, is quite easy to demonstrate from studies that is related to poor quality and safety performance, although not as strong the other way around. But certainly the impact of poor or weak or absent leadership does certainly seem to result in poorer, weaker, you know, worse outcome. So, building on this and moving on to the next slide, and just looking at another definition here, one which I think is quite interesting. It comes from the empowerment literature. It's actually by somebody of the name of Robinson back in the early 90s, but it's in one of Leishan's papers. And I like this because it conveys a certain sort of energy and excitement around this subject, which I think increasingly emerges from some of this work. So here we're talking about empowerment being a liberating sense of one's own strength. So certainly strength is something that features in all of the definitions you'll come across. So it's also, this author particularly feels that it's to do with feeling creative, feeling free to act, having that power surging into you from other people. So this whole dichotomy of empowered person versus empowerer, and where we as infection prevention and control practitioners sit, you know, we have to be empowered, certainly, to function and fulfill our roles effectively, but we, by and large and increasingly, are seeing ourselves as being the ones who are empowering others to perform to high standards of safety and quality and excellence in infection prevention and control. So this whole issue of power and energy and surging and growing and acting, I think this is what a big part of infection prevention and control is all about, actually. And so we move on through this journey to the next slide, and really just to pause for a second and remind ourselves on, you know, the value of looking at these sorts of conceptual things such as empowerment, and that if we do have this interest and exploration of the usefulness of things like empowering or being empowered, it has to relate to the bottom line. And by the bottom line, I'm not specifically talking about financial impact, but also, you know, that we are really valuing things that impact on the numbers of people who acquire infections, and that something like empowerment, if it is of value, if it does have impact, that it actually helps to reduce the numbers of people who die, who become ill, unwell, and suffer the ill effects of acquiring hospital or healthcare-associated infections. And, you know, does the goal or ability to strengthen the competence of others to give them this power surge that we saw in the previous definition, we should not lose sight of the fact that, you know, does it actually make a difference? And mixed messages from the literature, but emerging strong evidence, I think, that's coming out, particularly from the safety and quality movement, to give us some indication that it really does make a difference, and actually that it can make probably one of the biggest differences. And that's why I'm interested in this subject, and why I am delighted to be given the opportunity to talk today. So moving on to another paper on the next slide, and here we have a sort of intermediary slide now, a bridge between some of the specifics around empowerment. And this paper that some of you will have seen. It's pretty hot off the press, actually. Last year it was published in the American Journal by Manning. And Manning posed four questions, actually. And she was particularly interested in the future and the future role of infection preventionists, how we can influence the healthcare agenda moving into the 21st century. And Manning really suggested that we need to look back at where we've come from, how the whole agenda of infection prevention and control has evolved in the last half of the 20th century, because that actually shapes what we're about today. And if we do want to move forward with more progressive approaches to the reduction of healthcare infection, we do need to look back to look forward, if that makes sense. The Manning posed four questions. There are two of them here on this slide. The first related to, you know, introspectively asking ourselves, do we have the required leadership skills to move forward with confidence into, you know, the next stage of the 21st century? Can we as infection preventionists or infection prevention and control practitioners recognize and create influence opportunities? Or, I mean, she suggests, are we waiting for something that's never going to happen? And I think before moving on to the next and final two questions, the article really is all about the extent of our influence and the fact that historically many people who entered the position performed very sort of task-related functions, and there was a real focus on surveillance, and not that there isn't still a focus on surveillance, but there was this focus on surveillance and procedures and policies, and little, if any, attention was given to leadership proficiency. Now, we still focus on all of those things, but I think we do so within a much bigger sphere of influence around behaviour change and its impact, around leadership and its impact, and increasingly around things like the impact of culture and empowerment, which is what this is about. So moving on to address those final two questions that Manning poses on the next slide, and she says, can they successfully navigate organisations and its systems that exist now to influence and ensure survival and success? And finally, can we break free of some of the more insular focus that may, some say, be associated with some of our historical artefacts, and, you know, look at our contribution within the broader organisation? So positioning the practitioner now very differently to how we were positioned, perhaps when I started in this specialty 20 years ago. So what Manning concludes by suggesting is that, you know, in today's healthcare environment, the challenges perhaps are more than ever before for infection preventionists, that we're expected to lead, that we're expected to be improvement experts, provide expert consultation, be advocates, champions, developers, implementers, sustainers, measurers, evaluators, strategists, all in this pursuit of targeting zero healthcare-associated infections. And therefore, you know, I think very timely article that appeared last year in 2010, which suggests that, you know, we have a tremendous opportunity now to influence every level of healthcare and to influence patient outcome in its broadest context. So enough of that, and on to the next slide, which takes us back to some broader, higher level quality and safety type issues. So here you have the three columns of, or building blocks of, quality and safety. And just to put empowerment in the perspective here, and there are different models you can look at here, and I'm sure I'm much, you know, much more familiar with, but here we see leadership and management and standards of assurance and patient-centeredness sitting within this building block of culture and governance, and that sits alongside the whole issue of having the right infrastructures in place, the overall design for safety and quality rooted in the organisation, the processes of care established, the procedures, the skills, the pathways, etc. So we're talking about this middle building block, but the influence of all three of these really shouldn't be ignored here. So then moving on to the next slide, and just returning to not specifically a definition here, but trying to just keep going over and making sure that in the back of our mind we're asking some questions that are of importance when you look at this thing called empowerment. What is it? What actually is it? You know, what is it in its basic sort of black and white status? And it's had much criticism, and some authors have just described it as a buzzword and a fashionable buzzword at that, one that, you know, comes in and out of the literature, and then we move on to something that's a little bit more in fashion. But I think from all of the literature, it's certainly, as well as being a slippery issue, which some authors have said, it definitely is contextual and of the moment and a much used concept, and like power, it, you know, it does take on different forms in different contexts. But what emerges probably more than anything is that as nurses, we can only empower others if we are empowered ourselves. So that's one thing to put onto the table and, you know, to build on, really. So as nurses, we can only empower others if we're empowered ourselves. And therefore, how empowered are we as infection prevention and control nurses? And it does go building on from some of the things that have already been said, particularly some of the work of Manning, which was mentioned a couple of slides ago. If we move on to the next slide, really, when we start to explore what we're about in the field of infection prevention and control, I have put up here a source of knowledge that is used for many people. It's probably not the first port of call for people within the field of infection prevention and control, but it is where many people go to look for information. And how relevant is this to what I'm saying here? Well, if you look at Wikipedia here, you have a page on infection control. And I've highlighted, it's not a damningly negative take on infection control, but I have highlighted something which I will leave you to come to your own conclusions as to what this says about what we do. So as such, it is a practical, in brackets, rather than an academic subdiscipline of epidemiology. So a practical rather than an academic subdiscipline of epidemiology. We could argue about this, we could explore that further, we could debate it. But I think we're beginning to realise that that might have been something that infection prevention and control was concerned with in the past, but it's increasingly becoming a remnant of our historical roots, and we are about so much more than just being a sub-discipline of epidemiology, and that we are an emerging discipline in our own right, and that we do have a tremendous influence on healthcare and on healthcare outcomes, and that's why this whole subject of power and empowerment does matter. But I think if we just move on, continue on this theme a little more onto the next slide, you know, we have gone through this transition in probably the last 10, even maybe 20 years, but 10 years, definitely this, the last decade, we have moved from a controller very much to preventer, how we position ourselves in infection prevention and control, the image that we try to convey, has moved away from one of, you know, trying to stop the tide to actually trying to stop things from happening in the first place by putting in place the very systems that will ensure that infection prevention and control is designed into care processes or organisations from the outset. So much linked to what Manning was saying, linked to the perception that Wikipedia portrays of our specialty. And all of these things clearly do impact on our ability to be empowerers of other people. But essentially, we have moved away from a more sort of formal authority to having to gain people's respect in order to influence them and to develop almost a sort of personal sense of authority. But having that understanding of the use of power and the influence of power, and power itself, you know, has been the subject of much academic scrutiny, and it can be described in a number of ways in relation to healthcare. It's been described as the ability and willingness to affect the behaviour of others, and that's what I think with regard to empowerment I have been focusing on here as I've been considering power in its relationship to empowerment. So are we strong enough to influence others? Do we have the ability? Do we have the willingness? Do we have the positive energy to be the powerful people to influence the behaviours of others? Do we have the knowledge? Do we have the competence? And I will come back to that issue of competence certainly in the next few slides. Very briefly now, the next slide here just really again builds on this issue of influence and healthcare and the complexities of influencing practice and behaviours within these formal organisations which many of us work in, where you have to navigate many different external influencing factors or systems of influence, as they're called. And, you know, we work, many of us, or have worked in our career journeys in organisations where there are competing expertise interests. There's a whole hierarchy where different levels and different players have different levels of authority. There's a whole culture, and there are politics which impact on our individual power and influence and impact on our ability to function effectively. And therefore, as infection preventionists, we have to be able to navigate these different systems of influence. And this is difficult. There's a whole host of games that come into the picture here, but these systems of influence to some degree will influence wherever you're working within health and social care. And for leaders in positions of authority and leaders with expertise to be able to successfully improve the safety of patients and achieve infection prevention and control, to overcome those difficulties, we have to be aware of our own strengths and limitations. And moving on to the next slide, and just finishing really here, this historical influence that I think the reason I've given so much attention here is because even in 2011, to be a successful and powerful and motivational leader and empowerer and influencer and driver of change and a significant force really within our work environments, we do have to some extent a some degree of influence that comes from who we were historically, which might impinge on that. And we have come a long way, but it's not that long ago that it was 1962 and we were being employed as the helpers of the infection control doctors and the teachers of nurses to ensure that they basically did what the consultants wanted. But putting that to one side, because that's in itself the subject of a whole teleclass, moving on to the next slide, where we are now in 2011, where is the nurse? Where does the position of nursing rest in the public's imagination? We have many images of nursing that are commonplace on the TV. We have strong nurses, weak nurses, nasty nurses, funny nurses, empowered, disempowered. But on a serious note, the issue of the sort of negative stereotyping of the nurse, which can still exist, again, influences on not just our ability as infection preventionists, but the nurses were trying to influence the student nurses, the junior nurses, the inexperienced nurses, the nurses who are at the very beginning of their development into expert practice. We can't ignore these things when we talk about empowerment. We can't ignore them when we are trying to give power surges into the people who we're trying to influence. And I think that's something that probably will run through the remainder of the slides here as well. So moving on to the next slide is a figure that you will very much be familiar with from your training, from courses, from school, from general interest, this pyramid, this hierarchy of needs, which really has been around for many, many years, and which is where I first became familiar with this whole concept of empowerment. So at the top of the pyramid, this whole issue of self-actualization is precisely what empowerment is. And it's so important to remind ourselves as people who are trying to empower others and be empowered ourselves that you have to have in place all of these building blocks. And I urge people who are interested in this subject to just consider whether and to what extent all of those bases of the pyramid moving up are in place, both on a personal level and with regard to those who we're trying to influence. So is the work environment good and healthy, you know, addressing all of those basic physiological needs? Are the safety needs around security, the organisational security, the culture, the organisational esteem, moving up the pyramid, are all of those things in place? Because if not, then to try even to begin to empower nurses to change the world will fail, and it will fail miserably. So, as I said a few slides ago, it's extremely difficult to be empowered, to empower others in the healthcare organisations in which we work at the present time. And so building on to the next slide, linking really with some of the concepts that have been addressed so far, and trying to keep coming back to that question of where does this have any relevance to what we're about, empowerment and the nurse and the things that we do as infection preventionists around changing behaviour, around leadership, influencing strategies, power, systems of influence. Why does it matter? And in terms of some of the work that's gone before, I mentioned Larson earlier, and Elaine Larson did do an awful lot of work on this, as I say, way back in the 1990s, as did Professor Seto. And I'd strongly urge people to have a look back over that work, because really it sets the pace for what I've been talking about today and what you'll hear other speakers talk about in the coming teleclasses. So then moving on to the next slide, empowerment and specific aspects of infection prevention and control. And I say this really with some insight here, because if you just revisit the guidelines on hand hygiene, which were published now 2 years ago, so we have some consensus guidelines, and do they address this issue of nurse empowerment? Do they address the issue of empowerment? They do in a big way. They address empowerment within the context of both healthcare workers, but also, as you'll see in a moment, within the context of patients as well. And that's something perhaps when we talk about fashions and the fashionableness and the volatility of this concept, certainly in recent years we've seen the fashion around empowerment as something very much to do with empowering our patients and our clients. But sticking with these guidelines, I'd strongly urge again people to visit Chapter 18, just to remind yourself of the whole focus within those guidelines on the behavioural considerations around improving hand hygiene, and the fact that, you know, those guidelines very much focus on self-efficacy and the different models of behaviour change, looking at things like the theory of planned behaviour, the self-efficacy model, so relevant to impacting on hand hygiene performance and trying to address some of the defects in hand hygiene that we see, but also just to really act as a recap that this isn't a new concept. And when we talk about self-efficacy as one of the components of a multimodal strategy, that's actually what we mean. Self-efficacy is empowerment, empowering healthcare workers to understand and feel that they have within their grasp the ability to perform this consistently important practice at the right time. And you know, I think that's something that's really, you know, quite important here. And then moving on to the next slide, and picking up on the empowerment within the context of patients and their role in infection prevention and control, there's been some fantastic work done on this. It's a much debated issue even now as to what extent this really plays a role in changing behaviour and improving practices. And much of the work's come from hand hygiene, as it has for many of the good things that have emerged in recent years as being of utility for other aspects of our specialty. But again, you look back in those guidelines, there's a whole section. There are papers that have been published within the last year looking at the importance of patient empowerment within the multimodal strategy for hand hygiene. Within the UK, we've had our own work that's been undertaken on this, really trying to explore the extent to which promoting self-efficacy in patients can play a role in protecting them from the harm that results from the errors that occur in our hospitals and healthcare institutions. And moving on to the next slide, still a hot topic. So not just in relation to hand hygiene, infection prevention and control, patient safety errors. A report issued last year by Lord Darcy on the future of nursing and midwifery in England really, you know, brings to the fore some of these issues around Darcy, a direct quote from this report that Darcy says he sees frontline staff who want greater permission and encouragement to stand up for quality. So using that phrase, to stand up for quality, to challenge poor practice, to, you know, result in improvement. And he really reinforces a lot of what comes out of the literature is that from the very top, we must continue to empower people, i.e. nurses here, and others to improve services. So see it all coming together in this particular slide, and coming together even more in the next slide, and coming back to that issue that I've already mentioned around infection preventionists as empowered and empowerers. You know, to do all of these things that have been repeatedly mentioned so far, to change the behaviour of vast quantities of people in organisations, to implement measures that will impact on hundreds of thousands of millions of people's lives in terms of their outcome, and then to do it properly and to be able to reliably monitor and evaluate and get good results in order to sustain improvement, that's where empowerment matters, and that's where our role as empowerer of others matters more than anything, I believe, that we in the field of infection prevention and control have a great role to play in keeping quality and safety at its optimum level within healthcare. And infection prevention and control is one cornerstone of quality and safety. So then moving on to the next slide. Empowerment's important, and therefore, how do we address this? How do we move forward? We teach about it. Can we teach it to people? Can we make it? Can we package it up? Can we give it to people? Can we advocate for it? How do we actually, as usually quite individual practitioners within a monstrous beast of organisations, how do we and our small teams actually have any sort of impact in empowering others around infection prevention and control? And there's certainly some literature that suggests that it can and it should form part of education, that it can and it should form part of competency development, and I'll come on to talk about that very, very soon. So I think, yes, there are things we can do, but much of the achievement of an empowered workforce rests with a whole array of other things that we do to bring about a culture of safety and a safety climate. And I'm going to touch on that briefly in the next few slides. So then moving on now, just building this picture around what's the importance of empowerment. Moving on to the next slide. Some of you, and increasingly I'm sure many of you will be familiar with and aware of the Infection Prevention Society of the UK and Ireland's competencies. They are published this month in the Journal of Infection Prevention. There is an entire teleclass devoted to this issue, the Voices of IPS teleclass on the 12th of April, which if you have that interest, and I'm sure without doubt all of you will, I would strongly recommend this teleclass. But here I will cover this in a few slides because these competencies do have a relevance here to this whole issue of empowerment. And if you look at these outcome competencies, when we're talking about this issue of whether we can develop competencies, it's interesting to note from the paper in the Journal of Infection Prevention, this statement, the purpose of this framework, the outcome competencies framework, is not to define specific roles, but to assist practitioners to continually increase their existing knowledge, understanding and skills in order to reach our ultimate goal. So, if we move on to the next slide, the number of domains which these competencies address, and the fourth domain, leadership and management, is one that I will focus on today for speed, of course, but also because this within this domain four, leadership and management, we begin to address some of the issues around empowerment. And although empowerment isn't specifically mentioned explicitly, as you'll see in the next slide, it certainly is addressed within this whole issue of culture and safety. And therefore, the next slide, empowerment and IPS competencies. What we have here within Domain 4 is this statement: continuously assess and monitor the risks to safety and quality and challenge others' actions and decisions when they put individual populations and others at risk. So this is where empowerment sits within the new competencies, and very dependent on culture. And remember, culture is local, so it's a local thing. Even within an organisation with a healthy culture, you can have a local culture that actually will be much more of a dominant force for the good or the bad, and may not mirror that organisational culture because culture is dependent on individuals within the organisation as well. So the IPS competencies mention challenging others' actions and decisions when they put people at risk. And this is something, as I move on to the next set of slides and begin to look at some of the evidence that we have from recent years of the impact the empowered nurse can have on outcome, empowering nurses to challenge others when they see other people putting patients at risk. I think this really relates back to the work of people like Pronovost and Sexton, considering empowerment as critical in developing a culture of safety and the importance of measuring culture within all of that. So moving on to the next slide. A study was published in the Journal of Advanced Nursing last year by Deborah Ward, and really fascinating insight into student nurses' perspectives on empowerment that I think we can learn much from. And it's almost a reality check, really. So we have the competencies that talk about the need to assess and monitor the risks and that we should challenge others. Now, here we have a study that's recent and that suggests that that's not quite as easy as it sounds. The Ward study of empowerment and student nurses tells us a lot about the influence of local culture on the ability to be empowered. And one quote here, when she was talking to one of the students, exploring why some of the nurses perhaps were not empowered and were not challenging bad practice. And this one student said, no, they, the nurses, don't say anything to the doctors, probably because they just get ignored or shouted at and see the doctors as being higher than them. So if you think about the systems of influence, you know, the expertise, the authority, the culture, when we talk about empowering nurses, it sounds easy and it sounds simple, and it's been around for many years, as I've said, this whole concept, but the reason it's still talked about is because there are real barriers to successful implementation. So if we move on to the next slide, we have here some examples of where empowerment has been used, and we have a solution here that addresses this whole issue of how we can strengthen our ability to empower. And Atul Gawande's book, which some of you will be familiar with, The Checklist Manifesto, says that it's all about checklists. Checklists offer a way to overcome some of the limitations in scientific knowledge, to overcome the failure, the ineptitude, that control is within our grasp, and that we can improve empowerment for one example by using this ridiculously simple thing that is the checklist. So building on this and moving on to the next slide, some of you will be, in fact many of you will be very familiar in fact with some of the recent work that's been undertaken and disseminated in the last 2 years by the World Health Organization's Patient Safety Programme, where we've had the global dissemination of the Safe Surgery Checklist. We've got a work in progress developing a safe childbirth checklist. We have a clear illustration and example of patient empowerment and consumer public empowerment, where we have a group of patient activists actually working on developing a mother and baby safer care tool, so that the issue of empowerment really filtered through each of these three, both developed and in development, checklists from WHO patient safety, and using this thing called a checklist to almost give people the power, the permission, the incentive and the motivation and the rewards to act and to challenge in the pursuit of safety. Moving on to the next slide, this SCM, Swiss Cheese Model, and the subject of checklists and the prevention of HAE. Checklists have been used to ensure clearly here that, you know, we plug these defences, that we stop this trajectory of error from ever being able to occur by putting in place defence after defence after defence to address those gaps in the prevention of central line infections, of catheter-associated urinary tract infections. And we have policies, and we have the right equipment, and we train staff, and we monitor competence, and we move towards, you know, safety and nirvana. And checklists clearly offer us one component in our defences, our weaponry against error and defects in infection prevention and care. And it really is to the work of Pronovost that we see how all of this can come together and how we might apply it further in infection prevention and control. So moving on to the next slide, and I know many of you will be familiar with this work, but here we have the 2007 study, whereby in Pronovost's study, everything started with assessing culture safety. So he's here, both Pronovost and colleagues, really, really very vocal in emphasising that before you do anything to improve patient safety, you should measure your safety culture. And then you do your series of interventions, and then you re-measure, because without a safety culture, safety climate, you are completely wasting your time with your interventions, however sophisticated they may be. But what they did was they measured the culture. They put into place a number of interventions. As you can see, the fifth of those was nurse empowerment. to stop the procedure, and the procedure being the insertion of central lines. So here, nurses were empowered to challenge doctors, and if the doctor, the physician, failed to rectify the error or the violation of the procedure, then the nurse would page the senior doctor, and he would make sure that that more junior doctor did do the right thing. So it's a very, very clear cut illustration here of empowering nurses within a system where there's all sorts of influences and power imbalances, and trying to make sure that those were addressed in such a way that, that the right thing happened at the right time and that the patient remained safe. And then moving on to the next slide, really sticking with Pronovost's work, does empowerment have any impact on outcome? Going back to that one of those first slides, does it make any difference? Is it just a buzzword? Is it a fashion? Or does it really matter in patient safety and infection prevention and control? And I think, to me, one of the reasons I'm so interested in this, so hungry to learn of further research and even to be involved in further research myself, is that with regard to Pronovost's work, empowerment was strongest predictor of clinical excellence. So the strongest predictor of clinical excellence was caregivers, i.e. nurses, feeling comfortable speaking up when they perceived a problem with patient care, feeling that they had that surge of power running through their veins, that they could challenge a more senior clinical member of the multidisciplinary team, because patient safety was at the root of all of this, and the culture made them feel comfortable in doing that. And did it work? Yes. Good teamwork climate, good safety culture seemed to be directly related to zero bloodstream infection. So you really are beginning to see here the direct relationship between the culture, the empowerment, and outcome. And then there are some other studies that are emerging, and if you move on to the next slide, you'll see, I've just put another example here around some of the work from Shimoni that was published 2 years ago, and they looked at compliance with antibiotic prophylaxis in a caesarean section context. So Shimoni and colleagues studied the effect of empowering surgical nurses to ensure patients received antibiotics after caesarean, and the bottom line here seems to be that compliance increased from 25 to 100% when the surgical nurses were empowered. And in this study, there's some indication that it did make an impact on wound infection, i.e. outcome. So moving on to the next slide. So here we have a summary slide, in fact. Very much a whirlwind, as I mentioned, nearly 35 minutes ago. We have some evidence that empowerment of nurses works in terms of reducing HAI. Lucky for us that some of that seminal work on safety and quality was actually around an infection prevention and control topic, and Pronovost's work, you know, they really did work with the infection control teams in the efforts that they put in to address central line bloodstream infections. So for all of us working in this field, particularly in the light of recent studies, particularly in the light of the IPS competencies, we need to look inwards and consider, I think, whether we've fully embraced the concept in our day-to-day activities and how much we can use our ability as empowered, powerful influencers and leaders to empower, influence, and lead others and instill in others that sense of empowerment and influence in leaders themselves. So there's a few slides on the next page which look at some potential source of inspiration. At the end of your slide set, there are some selected references. But I would like to thank you for your time and say goodbye.
Julie, thank you very much. That was a tremendous presentation, and thank you for talking about Dr. Pronovost so much, because we happen to have a teleclass lecture in which he will be speaking. That is on June the 9th, entitled Using Checklists to Prevent Healthcare-Associated Infections. So thank you for promoting that so much. The idea of empowering nurses sounds an awful lot like what people are talking about in the field of positive deviance.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I didn't draw on any of that work, actually, but that's certainly something I did look at when I was doing some of the research behind this. Yeah, it certainly is. It's exactly what is addressed within that sort of broad umbrella of positive deviance. So there's a real connection there, I think. And we're beginning to see a lot of these things come together, and the whole issue of patient empowerment, for example, which I've done an awful lot of work on, has all of that, you know, academic, all the concepts behind it, the Maslow's hierarchy, this issue of self-efficacy. It relates to patient as well as to staff empowerment, but it's certainly been handled in a slightly different way.
That brings a whole hierarchical structure, that traditional hierarchical structure with the physicians as the godlike figures, kind of flattens that all out, doesn't it? So thank you very much. I really enjoyed this lecture. It's been very interesting. Your slides are fascinating. I see that you left your email address on slide number 34. Can I presume then that it's okay for people to contact you by email if they have questions?
Yes, certainly.
Right. Thank you very much. So thank you again, Julie, for a really interesting presentation. And to all of you who are joining us through the live teleclass or through the recording, thank you for your time today. And we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Goodbye.